From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the life and art of Jackson Pollock. The Museum of Modern Art in New York is showing the first major American retrospective of his work in 31 years. His dripped and poured paintings opened the doors to a new era of experimentation in art. His paintings sparked endless debate. His drinking and his temper added to the mythology that grew around him. We'll talk with Kirk Varnadeau, lead curator of the retrospective. And we remember former basketball player, coach, and manager Red Holtzman. He died Friday night. We'll hear an excerpt of our 1987 interview. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A United Nations plane carrying about 30 humanitarian workers has arrived in Iraq. Dozens more of the workers are traveling overland in a convoy of buses and cars. The workers oversee the UN distribution of food and medicine in Iraq. UN officials say most of the 100 weapons inspectors evacuated last week will return to Iraq tomorrow, with the rest to follow Wednesday. The latest showdown with Iraq ended over the weekend, and U.S. airstrikes were averted when Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein promised to allow a resumption of weapons inspections. NPR's Eric Weiner is in Baghdad, and he says the Iraqi press is putting a different spin on the story.
This is very much being portrayed as an Iraqi victory and a kind of defeat or humiliation for the United States. Most of the papers and state-run television here are trumpeting the Iraqi victory over the U.S. They say that it was the U.S. that backed down in this instance. One paper said that Iraq has once again pulled the carpet out from underneath the Americans. So there's very much a feeling here that Iraq has somehow outwitted the U.S. by avoiding airstrikes at the last minute.
NPR's Eric Weiner reporting from Baghdad. The Israeli troop pullback from the West Bank is on hold again. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he is suspending the withdrawal until the Palestinians drop plans to declare independence next spring, plans reiterated over the weekend by Yasser Arafat. The troop pullback, part of the peace accord worked out last month in the United States, was to have taken place this week. The Palestinian negotiator is accusing Netanyahu of trying to back out of his commitments. Vice President Al Gore has delivered a stinging attack against the government hosting the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC, summit. Gore suggested that Malaysia is not a true democracy, and he praised protesters who've been pushing for reform. Ryan Melzer reports from Kuala Lumpur.
Gore broke APEC tradition by criticizing the internal politics of another member country, and the host country at that. Gore was speaking to about 1,000 business leaders in the capital, Kuala Lumpur. He said the Malaysian people were brave for joining the calls for democracy across Asia, and he praised the reform movement launched by the country's former Deputy Prime Minister, Anwar Ibrahim, who is in jail facing charges of corruption and sexual misconduct. Gore's comments incensed the Malaysian government. The Minister of International Trade, Rafida Aziz, told reporters it was the most disgusting speech she had heard in her entire life, and she accused Gore of inciting protests. For NPR News, I'm Ryan Meltzer in Kuala Lumpur.
John Glenn is getting a hero's welcome in New York City today. He and his Space Shuttle Discovery crewmates are being honored with a ticker tape parade through the city. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 75 points in moderate trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 19. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the stock market appears to be taking the opportunity in advance of tomorrow's meeting by the Federal Reserve to log some substantial gains today, as NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Wall Street began moving higher shortly after the opening bell in New York this morning. Blue chip stocks moved back up above 9,000, though still a ways away from the market's all-time high of 93.37. That was set back in July. Along with anticipation about tomorrow's Federal Reserve Board meeting, investors apparently were not overly worried by the latest government economic numbers. The Fed reported industrial production fell 0.1% last month. The nation's mines and factories were operating at 80.6% of capacity. Part of the market optimism was the result of the announcement in Japan that the country's government has agreed on a 24 trillion yen, or more than 195 billion U.S. dollar economic stimulus package. It was also announced today the U.S. and Japan have agreed to pump $10 billion into the struggling Asian economies. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The $206 billion settlement between the tobacco industry and state governments is set to be announced this afternoon. The money would be used to help cover the government's cost of treating smoking-related illnesses. President Clinton plans to give his backing to the deal, which the White House is calling an important step forward. States will have until Friday to decide whether to sign on to the settlement, which is less sweeping than the national settlement that failed to win congressional approval earlier this year. Chrysler Corporation is going out in style. On the eve of the company's merger with Germany's Daimler-Benz, the automaker has seen two of its cars honored for excellence. Motor Trend magazine named the Chrysler 300M its 1999 Car of the Year, and the Jeep Grand Cherokee is the Off-Road magazine 4x4 of the Year. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jackson Pollock's dripped and poured paintings of the late 1940s and the 50s shook up the art world, changed the direction of modern art, and made him one of the most important and controversial artists of the century. Now the Museum of Modern Art in New York is showing the first major U.S. retrospective of his work in 31 years. My guest is the lead curator, Kirk Varnado, who organized the retrospective with Pepe Carmel. The show is described as a landmark, nearly perfect, by New York Times art critic Michael Kimmelman, who went on to say, "If you care about art, you live for exhibitions like this, in which an artist, against the heavy odds of his own skewed talent and unhinged personality, pursued something so wild, untested, and mysterious that its full meaning was unclear even to him." Kirk Varnado wrote a catalog essay in which he gets beneath the mythology that grew around Pollock. I asked him to start with the mythology itself.
Jackson Pollock's life has a tremendous drama to it. He struggles very hard in lonely isolation, comes out of a poor, itinerant family in the West, moves to New York, and after 10 years of very lonely misery in the Depression years, breaks through in the early 40s and comes to very high degree of success in the late 40s, has an article in Life magazine, becomes the king of the hill, from out of nowhere becomes the leading American painter of his generation, and then almost as precipitously falls into alcoholism, depression in the 50s, and then is killed in a car crash driving drunk in 1956. So it's a great American story of humble beginnings, giant success, tragic flaw, and violent death. It has all of the accoutrements of a great sort of mythic drama in the American popular culture sense. There are overtones in the image of Pollock that you see in those photographs in Life magazine in 1949, black denim, cigarette dangling off of his lips. There's a lot of Brando. There's a lot of James Dean. There's the whole sense of the rebel bohemian who pays the high price for his transgressions. All of this surrounds his artwork with an air of celebrity, stardom, and makes him the first of his kind, really, in the American visual arts that later Warhol and others would become, and that is a kind of star artist. And I think the myths of him, the myths of Pollock, have to do with the strongly tragic inflection one reads into that life.
And part of that image, too, is that macho that he brought to his painting and to his public image.
When Pollock appeared in Life magazine in 1949, leaning against his own painting with his arms crossed, sort of sneering at the camera with the cigarette dangling off his lips, I think most Life readers would have thought that an abstract painter was some curiously effete European with a beret and strange aesthetic theories. And the idea of this sort of working-class, tough guy, hard-drinking, bar-fighting image that Pollock projected was a complete revolution in consciousness about what modern art was for the American audience.
Let's look at his paintings and his actual approach to doing them, and then we'll get back to the story of his life and the story of his image. Pollock is most famous for splattering and dripping paint. He didn't like to use brushes. Would you describe his approach to painting during the most celebrated period of his career?
Yeah, beginning in 1947, Pollock took something that had been a marginal part of his own procedure as a painter and something that other painters had used in one form or another, and that is liquefied paint pour, dripped, splattered, drizzled, there are a number of different words that you would use, onto the canvas, with the canvas laid out on the floor beneath him. He did this sometimes by punching a hole in a paint can and using that to draw with as the paint dripped down, by pouring paint down a stick, by using a dried brush that would throw out a fan of paint. In many different techniques with varying degrees of force and with varying degrees of subtlety and control, he built up these webs of liquefied line on the canvas. And it wasn't as if he was pouring paint in order to draw a tree or draw a face. The whole composition of the canvas was a series of webs of movement and line, of the splotches and splatters, the frittered away vectors of line as he moved across areas, the puddlings of paint as they marbled together. The process of his art is apparent in the finished artwork and determines a lot of the shape. The actual materials he uses, the way they fall, the way they react to each other, determine the quality of the line, so that instead of executing a preordained schema or following a prepared drawing, he spun out literally in a spontaneous fashion, like a jazz artist, his composition as he worked. And the end result has no horizon, no up, no down, no center or side in the terms of standard compositions. It's instead a kind of cloud or pulsing web or a series of dendrites or synapses of linear energy. And that's all of these things were shocking, but I think the poured or dripped aspect suggested to many people a lack of control. It lacked the kind of touch or personality of an artist's brushwork, and it suggested an infatuation with chaos or accident.
Well, do you see Jackson Pollock's paintings as being involved with chance processes, or do you think that finally there's a sense of order that he, as the painter, brings to the canvas?
The more I look at Pollock's canvases, the more I'm impressed with the sense of control that he had over what he did. He did like the sense of dynamism and spontaneity. He liked to see the effect of paint as it fell. And every time he would make a mark, he would then respond to that mark. So if there was an accident or an occurrence that he didn't like on the canvas, he would tend to paint over it. These pictures are generally done in layers, and each layer would respond to, adjust, correct, cover over the previous layer in selective fashion. He had the kind of control which is not planned. It's not like he's a strategic artist, but like a great athlete or like a ballet dancer, he had an amazing feel for the movement of his body in the air, for the medium that he was using, in which, though he was engaged in the act of painting and not reflecting on it, he still had a fine degree of control between the thick and the thin, the speed, the puddle, the splatter of the line that he was using. And if you look at the paintings, you'll see that the so-called drip method or pouring method is not one style, that he had to reinvent it on widely differing scales, so that the same gestures he made in the compass of a wrist had to be reinvented to hold the sweep of an arm across a canvas 10 feet high, and lines that were 3 inches thick at some point had to be recalibrated in smaller works to be as fine as a hair. That there's this constant sense of reinvention and an enormous variety of expression in the work. So he was able to control not only the palette and the color, but the feeling that the work was aggressive or joyous, light and dancing, or nebular and lush. There's a broad range of effect in this work that suggests that he knew very strongly the character of each picture as he worked on it and pulled that character out.
My guest is Kirk Varnado, and he is the curator of the Jackson Pollock Show now at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Pollock liked to paint with the canvas on the floor, which is different from the perspective painters usually use till that point, which is on an easel or on the wall. What did it give him to be able to work on the floor?
You know, the first statement that he made about working on the floor when he talked about the way he liked to work, he talked about the resistance of pushing against a hard material. Instead of stretching a canvas taut on a standard stretcher the way a lot of artists do, he first worked with it nailed to the wall. He liked the resistance. He liked to push. And then when he got it on the floor, he not only got to push against something hard as he put the paint down on the canvas, he also got to work on it from all sides so that he could walk around it, work the top, work the bottom, work the sides, and somehow feel that he was inside the canvas. inevitably, when you set something up on the wall, the connotation is like a window. It's something you're looking into in a frame. But when the work is down on the floor, it's a receiving ground. You have a different relationship with your body to the work that you're making. And I think that his sense of liking to be in the picture or over the picture, to feel the work falling down on it and the floorboards pushing back up, was something that got him into working on the floor. The remarkable thing is that during the great period of the poured and drip paintings, it was precisely that sense of resistance or friction that he seemed to like so much when he started working on hard surfaces that he gave up and internalized or sublimated into this choreography in the air just above the canvas that let the material fall. So there's a kind of muscular tension built into the way that he works, which is like a residue or a memory of his push against the hard surfaces of the floor and the wall in his early work.
So Pollock really works with gravity in some respects.
Very much so. And, you know, I think when Pollock's works were shown in 1967, they had the greatest impact on young sculptors precisely because of the sense of gravity in his work. There were many people who felt that Pollock had, in a certain sense, pulled all the air out of the room for painters, that his statement was so extreme that there was no way to follow him without being merely an imitator. But for young sculptors in the late 60s, seeing the Pollock retrospective in the context of an era then dominated by hard-edged geometry and minimalism or the very sharp, bright colors of pop, young artists like Richard Serra or Eva Hess or Robert Smithson felt that Pollock's work with gravity and his willingness to let materials have their own form, to respond to the dynamic of the tarriness and liquidity of black paint, to use silver paint, to let things fall, opened up a whole body of installation sculpture, people who worked with detritus flung down on the ground, Richard Serra's thrown lead pieces, Robert Smithson's poured asphalt pieces, the dialogue with the concrete materiality of property. For a lot of Pollock's contemporaries, it was the subjective spirit that seemed to be important. It was the psychological trauma that seemed to be inherent in his work. But for artists of the late 60s, it was the concrete materiality and specifically the relationship to gravity and weight that was so impressive.
What do you think Pollock's drip paintings represent in terms of a conceptual breakthrough in art?
Well, like many moments in modern art, Pollock's breakthrough in 1947-48 had a tremendous destructive force. It seemed to eliminate many things on which painting had traditionally depended. No standard composition, even cubism depended, not though it obviously rejected the idea of imitation of the natural world, it still depended on a compositional relationship of opposing masses. There was something in the picture about balance and construction and structure. Pollock seemed to void all of that, to get that out of there. He seemed to make the process almost take dominance over the product, and he seemed to give up on any notion of art fulfilling a plan. In fact, art seemed to be the result of a form of behavior in a way that opened up into happenings, into performance art. One of the things that's astonishing about Pollock and his legacy is that the breakthrough he made and the kind of art he made seemed to feed or nurture artists who produced work radically different in appearance from his own work. So Pollock's breakthrough was to give a new sense of permission to a lot of different artists.
You know, you write in your catalog essay that Pollock not only, you know, Pollock's paintings were not only free from representation, but from symbolism as well. Was that an important breakthrough to free painting from symbolism?
Well, I think especially given the immediate context of the work that Pollock and many of his contemporaries were producing around the time of World War II in 1943, 44, 45, extremely dark period for the world. There was a heavy emphasis on works that seemed to have a kind of primordial, totemic, mystical symbolism. He painted a lot of pictures which seemed like puzzles with portentous titles like Guardians of the Secret and titles that referred to the unconscious. There's been a great deal of Jungian interpretation of the symbolic language of Pollock's work. It's something that he inherited as well from the Surrealists in Europe and from Picasso. And there was this huge freight of unknown secrets and mysterious imaginings of the deep unconscious of the race, etc., etc. And then when Pollock broke through and produced this new kind of painting without imagery, where the paint was flung down on the canvas, suddenly you had pictures which had no agenda. In fact, he even began to title them with numbers. Instead of using poetic or evocative titles in 1948, he just titled the pictures Number 1, 1948, or Number 2, 1948, in order to distance them from this kind of literary reading in and to make people focus on the present tense aspect of their abstract properties as works of art. And that was a very radical snuffing out of something that had been the mark of seriousness for art only a couple of years earlier.
My guest is Kirk Varnado, and he curated the Jackson Pollock Show, which is at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and he wrote the main catalog essay for the accompanying book. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kirk Varnado. He's the lead curator of the Jackson Pollock Show, now on exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. He also wrote the main catalog essay. I found it very interesting in reading the essay that, until Pollock started experimenting with the techniques that he originated, he thought of his art as kind of derivative and unremarkable, and other people thought of it that way as well.
Yeah, Pollock was no Mozart. I mean, it's really unusual. He had a fixation from very early on as a teenager that he wanted to be an artist. I think his older brother, Charles, who was about 8 years old, 8 years older, had pursued a career in art. And I think that Pollock, watching him leave home and establishing himself outside, got the idea that this was a way to get out of his circumstances. And this was something he could be that would be different from what he had been as a child. But he had no talent for it whatsoever. Charles had a certain amount of talent. The brother closest to Jackson in age, Sandy, also pursued a career in art. He was recognized as having a certain kind of talent. Everybody looked at Pollock and his brother's description. If you'd seen those drawings, you would have advised him to become a tennis player or a plumber. He just really was struggling. And when he went to New York to study with Thomas Hart Benton, he was one of the least facile of the draftsmen in Benton's classes, the most struggling, the toughest in drawing. And he worked very, very hard, labored at it. But somewhere this driving ambition to become an artist in the late 30s forced Pollock face-to-face with Picasso. He just was determined that he was going to beat the greatest artist in the world at his own game. And in order to do that, he had to kind of swallow Picasso whole. So that when he saw Picasso's Guernica in New York and when he saw the great Picasso retrospective at the Modern in 1939, he completely absorbed, plunged himself into Picasso's symbolism, and picking up pieces from other artists as well, he began to hammer together the style. And when he first started showing in 1942, 43, the critics who walked into the show said, "Oh yeah, I see. There's this much Picasso, there's this much Beckman, there's a little Kandinsky, there's this much Miro." All the sources were evident, and yet, they all looked at the painting and said, "Ooh, but yes, but this guy is original." There was a force, and I think you feel it when you get those pictures grouped together again, that the way he put the paint on canvas, and in fact, the very force of the struggle with the masters he was trying to come to terms with, is evident in the pictures and gives them a kind of special authenticity.
His breakthrough painting, I think, was the 1943 mural that he did for Peggy Guggenheim, the art collector and gallery owner and an heiress, I suppose. What was the commission that she presented to him?
Well, Peggy Guggenheim had just opened a new gallery called Art of This Century. She'd moved to the U.S. from Europe in light of the war, and she brought with her a great collection of avant-garde art. And she had the idea that she was going to mix her collection of European modernists with showing younger American artists. And so she had advisors among curators in New York, and they spotted Pollock as a talent. She signed Pollock to a contract, and she scheduled him for a first monographic show in 1943. And in that summer, in preparation for the show, she commissioned Pollock to paint a big mural for the foyer of her apartment on the Upper East Side. And Marcel Duchamp, who was very canny, said, "Don't let him do it on the wall because you may move. Have him paint it on canvas." So she commissioned an 18-foot-long canvas for about 9 or 10 feet high for the foyer of her apartment, in principle to be finished in time for the show in November. And Pollock didn't even have a room big enough to paint an 18-foot-long canvas, so he and his wife, Lee, surreptitiously tore down a wall in their apartment and took the drywall out in buckets at night so the landlord wouldn't know what they were doing, so they could open up a wall between two rooms large enough to stretch this canvas. And the accounts that we have suggest that the canvas stayed there bare all during the summer. Pollock was working like a demon in August, producing many of the more moderate-sized pictures that went into the show in 43. But apparently, by the time of November and the time of the exhibition, the big mural was still unfinished. And there are even witness accounts of people who went to dinner with Pollock just before Christmas who claimed that there was absolutely nothing on the canvas. And the story goes that Peggy Guggenheim was having a party somewhere in mid-January and said, "Okay, either that mural is on my wall or you are history. Get that thing done." And according to Lee Krasner, Pollock then sort of locks himself in the room and in one night and day, in about a 15-hour session, rips this thing off. It's a real sort of Paul Bunyan exploit story, and it sparks a certain amount of cynicism. And yet, when you look at the picture, there's clearly nothing labored or premeditated about the picture. It has an enormous surge. It's basically a kind of frieze of turbulent stick figure type vectors that stampede across these 18 feet of the canvas, and it's done with tremendous brio. There's very little second thinking about it. There's no composition under it, and it seems to have been done, if not exactly in those circumstances, certainly in an all-out blitz of work, of a tremendous spontaneity that seems to untie every knot that's constricted together in all the rest of Pollock's work at the time. It makes the rest of Pollock's work at the time look comparatively stiff and packed and forced, whereas this thing just lets loose a fantastic cavalcade of energy in a way that's very premonitory of the large later drip paintings.
But he's not dripping yet.
No, this is all done with a brush.
Kirk Varnadeau is chief curator of painting and sculpture at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. He'll be back in the second half of the show. The Pollock retrospective is on view at the museum till February 2nd. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our conversation about Jackson Pollock, and we remember basketball player, coach, and manager Red Holtzman. He died Friday night at the age of 78. He led the New York Knicks to their two NBA championships. He started playing before the NBA was formed. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Kirk Varnadeau, lead curator of the Jackson Pollock Retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. He also wrote an essay in the catalog published by the museum. When we left off, we were talking about Pollock's breakthrough painting, a mural commissioned in 1944 by Peggy Guggenheim for the hallway of her townhouse. So he does this mural for Peggy Guggenheim. A couple of years later, moves to East Hampton, Long Island, which is a beautiful kind of rural area and the outer part of Long Island. Why did he and his wife Lee Krasner move from Manhattan?
Well, Lee Krasner was 4 years older than Jackson, and she had met him around 1942, and she saw that he had a lot of troubles and that those troubles were closely tied up with alcohol. And I think that she certainly had a strong vision of his potential as an artist. She was very convinced that he was a great talent. And they had gone out for the summer to visit friends in the Hamptons, and she saw that he was much more at ease in nature and that being away from the city did him a lot of good. So it's a very strong idea that if they moved there, he'd be able to concentrate on his art better and their life would be simpler because he would be away from his cronies in the city and away from the bars. So she put down the ultimatum that they get married because she, for one thing, didn't think that outside the city, cohabitation without marriage would be so favorably looked on by the villagers around East Hampton. And they bought a small 19th century farmhouse with a little barn right on in this area called the Springs in the East Hampton village. And they had no automobile. They had a bicycle, and they walked for the first couple of years they were out there. And this was not the Hamptons of today. This was truly isolated. It was a long way out. And Pollock had now contact with the ocean. He said that he thought the vast span of the Atlantic Ocean was the only East Coast equivalent for the spaces that he'd grown up with as a child in the West. And you see right away that the two series that he painted in 1946, the first year that he's really fully painting out there, are titled the Akabonic Creek series, which is right after the small stream that runs by their property, and the other one was called the Sounds in the Grass series. And both of them are evocative of his new closeness to nature. So it's the distance from the bars, in some sense, and the closeness to nature on the other, and just the sheer isolation and focus, which I think had a crucial role in promoting the advance of Pollock's art in that period.
He set up his studio in a little barn, which you describe as really being more the size of a tool shed. You've been in that barn. What was it like to be in there, and what was surprising about the experience of being inside it?
I really thought that one of the cores of my experience in doing the show and my feeling about Pollock was the moment when I stepped up, and you actually, it's almost like going onto a stage because he moved this little barn and put in a new floor. So you actually step up a foot or so onto the floor that he painted on. And the floor is still the same, when Pollock got a little money at the end of his life, he put insulation on this barn and white wallboard, and then Lee Krasner used it as a studio and put up lights. But you have to imagine it as it was when Pollock first worked in it. Bare boards, the wind whistled through, you could see through the boards to the outside. He had no electricity in it. He could only paint in the daytime, and he could really only paint in good weather. He couldn't use it all winter. The astonishing thing about the space, however, is how incredibly small it is. If you're used to the large paintings that we see regularly in New York, the big one, number 31, 1950, that the Museum of Modern Art owns, or Autumn Rhythm, which the Metropolitan owns, these things are colossal, and they seem to have a vast, expansive space, and you suddenly find yourself in this closet. And the feeling first is, no, I just don't believe it. These canvases couldn't fit. And then you take the tape measure out and you see that indeed when he put them on the floor, they nearly touched both walls and left him only a narrow zone to work in. And after you accept that physically they fit, then you have to come to terms with how it is possible to imagine the spaces that are in those paintings when you are physically in such a restricted and small space. We have a lot of photographs of Pollock working in this space, and they're taken by Hans Namath, the photographer of Pollock at work. And Namath would often get himself up into the rafters to take pictures of Pollock, looking down at Pollock working on the canvases. And the photographs are very deceptive. They would lead you to believe the space is like a New York loft. Not at all. It's like a tiny New York closet in a way, and it's truly striking to stand there and see how little distance Pollock could get from these works. We're used to standing back 15, 20 feet, you know, and then moving back further. This was a 21-foot square, this little room, and its sides were stacked up with the canvases that he had already completed. So he had even less working room, and all the pictures he had already made pressed in from all sides around him. It's an astonishing readjustment of the mind to stand in that space. And for that very reason, in the exhibition at the Modern, we have recreated to exact scale and with old barn board the studio so that the visitors to the exhibition can get precisely that shock of disjunction between the material circumstances and the results.
You know, it's funny, the first color plate in the catalog of the Pollock Show, I thought it was a really nice painting. It turns out it was the photograph of the floor of his studio with all the paint splattered on it.
That's right. The floor was covered. Pollock covered the floor with board when he got a little money. And then Lee Krasner used it with this board covered for a long time. But when Lee died, they discovered that they could take the board up, and there's the floor as it was in the early 50s and late 40s when Pollock was painting the pictures on the floor. And you can actually find edges and bits of known paintings by particular types of color that comes off the side, and the traces and ghosts of those pictures are still there, and it's one of the things that makes this a kind of place of pilgrimage for Pollock devotees.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kirk Varnadeau, and he's the lead curator of the Jackson Pollock Show, which is on exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. He also wrote the main catalog essay. What was the painting that you consider his first great drip painting, the painting that really established the process, that was the process he became best known for?
I don't think there's any one breakthrough painting. There are a group of paintings where he used a lot of poured paint to cover pre-existing compositions, and they're clearly transitional. And then there are a body of paintings in 1947 that are done entirely with the drip method. Cathedral in the museum in Dallas, Lucifer in a private collection in California. These are the first pictures where you feel the painting is determined very strongly in its whole, complete, from beginning to end, existence by the poured process.
You write that Pollock had one great overpowering idea. It came to him at the end of 1946, produced some of the most inexhaustible artworks of the century over almost 4 years, and then was over as abruptly as it had begun. What happened? Was he blocked? Was he tired of the style he had created?
The million-dollar question, in a certain sense, is why he stopped. There are many contingent factors. Pollock, who had a problem with alcoholism throughout his life, was in fact sober from 48 to 50, partly because of a doctor who prescribed tranquilizers for him and who he trusted. And the doctor was killed in a car crash in the spring of 50. So when the great tension came for Pollock's largest show of drip paintings in the fall of 50, he had no fallback position. He started drinking again very strongly. The show didn't sell. He got profoundly depressed and started drinking more, and things began spiraling down. What's clear is that he was unwilling to repeat himself, that having risen to a certain summit on this motif and this way of painting, that though they were still in demand, he was unwilling to go back. He wanted to find some new way, and he simply never found himself again as strongly.
Now, the problems that he had with depression and alcoholism, those were problems that originated when he was much younger.
He started drinking when he was 15, and it's clear that he had no tolerance for it, that he was very weak for it, and he clearly had emotional disturbances. He was a pugnacious youth. He slugged a couple of instructors in grade school and high school. He was thrown out of high school a couple of times. He clearly had a real problem with authority and discipline. Even though he sought out father-like mentors in Benton and Graham and the other instructors that he had in art, he had a real social problem, and he had a drinking problem, and the two of them linked together. And it's very hard now to know psychoanalytically what the roots of these issues were for him.
My guest is Kirk Varnado, curator of painting and sculpture at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kirk Varnado, lead curator of the Jackson Pollock Retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Describe how Pollock died.
Pollock, at the end of his life, had been drinking a great, great deal. He had split up with his wife, more or less, Lee Krasner. They were in very bad terms. Lee had gone to Europe in the summer of 56, and a girlfriend that Pollock had met in a bar in New York came out to the Hamptons to visit on Saturday, August 11th, 1956, and she brought a friend of hers with her. Pollock drank all afternoon, and they started driving at night. They were driving towards Pollock's house, and Pollock was driving too fast. The friend of the girlfriend started shrieking, "Let me out of the car." That goaded Pollock to drive faster. He flipped his Oldsmobile convertible, and his girlfriend survived, but her friend was crushed beneath the car, and Pollock was thrown out of the car and hit a tree and died instantly.
How do you think his early death affected his reputation and his legend?
I think that the market for New York art was poised to accelerate anyway. The late 50s were a period of time for enormous expansion for American culture and the world in general, and prices started going up sharply. But Pollock's death and the rarity that introduced into his work obviously boosted his prices enormously as this general wave happened in the late 50s. And I think that it's clear that he was not headed in a good direction when he died, and the fact that the life was snuffed out and stopped short gave it a kind of tragic wholeness that made it mythic in the eyes and in the minds of many people, confirmed his role in the popular imagination as a tragic rebel, and that can't have hurt. On the other hand, I think it was great art. It always was great art that he produced. It's proved to be, over the years, fabulous and terrific art. And the art transcends whatever myth surrounds it, I believe.
Now, how do you think critical evaluations of him have changed over the years?
I think in the 1950s and even afterwards, one tended to look at Pollock's art as a kind of direct extension of his life, that you had a turbulent turmoil of a life that realized itself in an angst-filled, storm-tossed set of pictures. And yet now when we look back at these pictures, we see that there are elements of real lyricism and beautiful, delicate, decorative properties in these pictures that are absolutely the opposite of the macho bar fighter that everybody presumed earlier. Similarly, I think people looked at the pictures earlier as the representation of the kind of fragmentation of the atomic age, of a kind of alienation or apocalyptic energy, whereas now one can see them as suffused with a kind of romanticism. I think that over the years we've become to deal more with the pictures themselves as a life lived on canvas, independent of or separate from the life that the man lived, and related to its time, but also larger than that. And we're still in the process of understanding these pictures.
What do you think the difference is between the great and the not-so-great paintings that he did? Well, How do you critically evaluate one from another?
People may differ on which pictures they think are the most successful, but I think it's clear that Pollock was working with an edgy technique. It certainly was no guarantee of success. There were all sorts of things that could possibly go wrong, and when they go wrong in several directions. On the one hand, his use of material can get grotesque, choked, too meaty, no sufficient air left in it, lumped up like just detritus material. On the other hand, he had a kind of weakness for pretty effects, and things can get almost too fussy and very lavish colors. He uses silver. He flirts with really vulgar taste in some of his colors. So the pictures can fork off towards a kind of over-fussy prettiness or a kind of over-meaty grotesquerie. When he's at his best, they have a kind of wonderful aerated surge of energy where all of the properties of angriness and anger and joy and are brought together and held in suspension.
Now, you spoke a little bit earlier about how you think Pollock's paintings influenced other painters and other sculptors. I'm wondering about how you think his life influenced younger artists who are always trying to live up to their role models and copy them.
You know, I think Pollock's life is one of those things that people like to dream about but not imitate. Almost immediately after Pollock died, in the late 1950s and early 1960s, you got the model of Jasper Johns or then Andy Warhol, much more detached from the work. Warhol's model of an artist building a career in a certain sense, living in the city, being hip, being urban, being ironic, being detached, the sense of burning yourself up for your art, which was a kind of ideal of Pollock's generation, a beat generation idea of authenticity gained by spurning the world and plunging into the work. That's not an ideal that was very attractive to artists in the 60s who wanted something a little more distant, a little more cerebral, or more ironic. And I think that the sort of romanticized Pollock, the bohemian tragic Pollock, has not been the kind of thing very many artists have been willing to model their actual working life after.
When it came to actually hanging the show, what were the biggest issues for you?
I was clearly determined at the outset that the core, the emotional core of the show, would be the reuniting of the three great monumental canvases that he painted in the summer and early autumn of 1950. One's owned by the Modern, one's owned by the Metropolitan, and one's owned by Dusseldorf. So I had to design the show to give these things both enough space to breathe and enough proximity that one could feel their energies working together in the way they did in the Betty Parsons show. And then subsequent concerns were how to deal with the decline of his talents in the later years so that one was honest about the full range of the career without burdening the viewer who's been so exhilarated by the highs of the middle part of the show with a long, dreary trajectory to end the show on a whimper. There were many problems about being complete and being exclusive that had to be solved room by room.
Are there any questions you most wish that you could have asked Jackson Pollock?
You know, I don't think that Jackson Pollock was a man of words, and I'm not sure how profitable it would have been to ask him questions. I think that in the best sense, much of what he did was, if not unconscious, then certainly at an intuitive level that didn't lend itself to expression. All the radio interviews, all the things I've ever, and he is on tape, you can hear him, or you can read him. I think Jackson Pollock's most effective, most powerful form of communication was in paint on canvas. And while it was very hard for me and very difficult to do the entire exhibition never having known the man, I've talked to people who did know him and they said, don't be so quick to believe this is a disadvantage.
Well, Kirk Vonnerdo, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about the Pollock Show.
Thank you very much.
Kirk Vonnerdo is the lead curator of the Jackson Pollock Retrospective, which is on view at the Museum of Modern Art in New York till February 2nd. Vonnerdo wrote an essay in the catalog published by the museum. Coming up, we remember Basketball Hall of Fame coach Rhett Holtzman. This is Fresh Air. Basketball Hall of Fame coach Red Holtzman died Friday night at the age of 78. He had leukemia. New York Times sports writer Ira Berkow described Holtzman as the architect of one of the most unusual, most thrilling teams ever assembled, the Knicks team that included Willis Reed, Bill Bradley, Cassie Russell, and Dave DeBuscher. Holtzman recruited most of the team members when he scouted for the Knicks. In 1970 and 73, Holtzman led the Knicks to their only two NBA championships. When Holtzman retired from coaching in 1982, he was second to Red Auerbach in the number of victories in regular season play. He started his career playing with the Rochester Royals and the Milwaukee Hawks. I spoke with Red Holtzman in 1987 and asked him to describe the techniques he used to get the best performance out of his players.
Well, I think the most important thing that we tried to do when I came in was to get them to play a brand of team basketball that would help us. I felt that you get teams that don't play as a team, no matter how much talent they have, they're not going to be a winning team. So that was the first thing we had in mind, is to instill pride in being part of a team type of thing. And the next, almost as important, is to get them to play good team defense. So very often your defense makes your offense, and these are the things that make for good teams. Those two things. And then to put your talents in the team and use it together, do all the things together. And that's what they did. They were a very, very intelligent group.
Did that get harder to do over the years? Did it get harder to have the players really function as a team, as opposed to just going for their own statistics?
I think it did. I think it got harder over the years because the money became more of a factor. The money got, you know, very, very big, and you couldn't blame players for wanting to make more money or striving to make more money. And a lot of them thought that the only way to get it was to shoot a lot and score a lot. Of course, that was not always true. If they didn't have the ability to do that, they fell by the wayside. So I think that the money factor took away from that aspect of the game a little bit. But, of course, still the good teams do these team things and do these team defensive things together.
Do you think that fans appreciate good teamwork as much as they appreciate someone who can make a lot of baskets, do a lot of shooting?
I think they like to see outstanding players, and they like to see players do outstanding things on an individual basis, but they like to see good team basketball, and they like to see good team basketball if it gets results. If you're out there and you're not getting results, then they're not going to buy it. They're going to say, yeah, that stuff doesn't work, you know. And but the thing is that if it does work, everybody is a part of it, and they're proud of it. You know, all of a sudden we know something that somebody else don't know, you know, and we're pressing. Our defense was a pressing type of defense, and it was working. So that was a great thing.
Was there something that you always felt, well, if I were a coach, I would do it this way? Something like that you actually were able to put into effect once you started coaching?
Well, I think that, you know, that's inherent in everybody that's been involved in anything. You know, if you really love it and are serious about it, you're always thinking about something that you would do that would be better than what's being done. And my background was with, you know, people who had me play this type of defense, this type of basketball, this type of stuff that we did in the schoolyards in Brooklyn, you know. And I played for guys like Nat Holman, who was a great coach at City College, and I played up in Rochester. You know, so all this stuff was based on the team stuff, passing the ball and helping each other, playing good defense. So It was in my background, you know. It was always there, and I always felt that was the number one way to go.
Whenever you watch a basketball game on TV, there are, of course, cutaways from the court to the coach on the sidelines, who's shouting and screaming and urging on the players. Did you dread those cutaway shots to you?
Well, I didn't dread them because I was too busy trying to do what I could do. But, you know, you have to have a lot of ego, and you got to be a little crazy to be a coach, you know, and you got to make a fool of yourself occasionally. So we all did that. But the cutaway shots were part of the business. And the only thing I didn't like about, and I wouldn't let people do it, is take their mics into the huddle, you know, with timeouts and things mm-hmm. like that. I figured we ought to have some secrets, you know, and everybody say, oh, boy, I wonder what he's telling him now, something brilliant, I suppose, you know, and maybe I'm telling the guy to get the bus warm or something, and we'll be out, and we're going to go to dinner early or something like that. But you got to have some secrets, and that's one thing I didn't go for.
Back when you were a scout, you were scouting at at Grambling College, which is a Southern Black college. And in your book, you write that it was interesting that all the players were Black, but a lot of the white students from nearby colleges had come and were cheering on the students from Grambling. And you said that you thought this really foreshadowed how the NBA would change. Would you explain that?
Yeah, well, at that time, Grambling played some of the best basketball around, you know. That was before all the big colleges were taking Black players, and they really had the best players in the country. We got Willis Reed from Grambling, and the people who were basketball fans who wanted to see good basketball came to Grambling. They went there to see it, and all these great players were being watched in the small colleges. Didn't make any difference where you went. You went to see the best players, and that's where they were. So I think that this was a sign of things that were going to happen, and it was great.
Well, I think when you started playing, there were virtually no Black professional players.
There were almost no Black professional players, except some teams that were entirely Black teams, like the New York Renaissance, who were a great, great basketball team, and the Harlem Globetrotters and the Washington Generals. They had some great, great all-Black teams, but in the National League and later on, actually, the Rochester Royals, who were owned by Lester Harrison, the guy that owned my team there, was the first man to sign Black players. He signed two great Black players out of New York, Dolly King and Pop Gates. And he was actually the first man to do that. And I think it's to his credit because, it was a start and it helped.
Now that you're retired, are you still doing any consulting?
I'm a consultant. I'm available to be consulted. I hope it's about basketball, because otherwise we'd be in trouble. But I'm available. But, you know, the trouble with being consulted too much in basketball is that you're not there every day. You know, you're not in on the daily things that are happening. So it's a little difficult. But a consultant is a guy that you might ask something once in a while. But basically a consultant is a guy that you owe money to. And
an interesting definition. I'll remember that.
Remember that. That if you ever get old enough to get a consultant's job, grab it. It's a great job. The Knicks have been very, very nice. They treat me with a great deal of respect, and it's just a joy to go to the games at the Garden. And my wife and I have a lot of fun, and it keeps us busy. And if I'm there and I can help, I'm always glad to do that.
Red Holtzman recorded in 1987. He died Friday of complications from leukemia. He was 78. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Alan Tu, Amy Sallet, and Joan Tui Westman, with Monique Nazareth and Anne-Marie Boldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.